Hi. It's a funny title. This panel is actually quite serious. It will deal with literary criticism of satire and how it works within the Mormon community. Our first speaker is Mike Austin, who you heard this morning as our devotional speaker. I will say again, he is an assistant professor at in Shepherdston, West Virginia, just west of here. He did his PhD in English literature at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and 18th century literature and satire has been part of his professional training. He's now combining that with his interest in Mormon studies, which is also, as we know from his devotional, part of his professional performance. And he is the one who gave us the title for this panel. So I give you now Mike Austin, who will tell us how Jesus was a funny guy.
Actually, my purpose on the panel isn't to talk that much about Jesus. It's to talk about satire as a literary manner, as a literary genre, talk about where satire comes from, what it means, and how we might think about satire in the context of Mormon satire, which is the purpose of this panel, is to discuss is there such a thing as a Mormon satire? Can there be? Should there be? And what does Jesus being a funny guy have to say about that? I would like to begin the panel by drawing a sharp distinction between satire and humor. The two terms are often conflated, with the implication being that anything that makes fun of something else is therefore satirizing it. While it is true that satire is always, by definition, humorous, it is a very specific kind of humor. Not everything that is humorous is satirical. I would go as far as to say the vast majority of things that are humorous are not satirical. My purpose in the panel is to refute the automatic conflation of making fun of with satirizing, and to talk about a very specific way that satire as a literary manner relates to the cultures which it is satirizing or the societies which it is criticizing. To do this, I'm going to use some literary distinctions and invoke some very standard literary terms in a somewhat idiosyncratic way. Most of the terms here are my take on things. I offer them not as orthodoxies to live by, but only as tools to think with and to abandon as soon as one wants to abandon them. But satire is a very old, very established, it's one of the oldest classical literary traditions. Epic, lyric, satire, tragedy are probably the oldest kinds of literature we have. The word satire comes from a Latin word meaning a bowl of mixed fruit, which has little to do with what satire is now, except that it's mixed. And that mixing is crucial to what satire means today. I'm going to give, just right from the Holman Harmon Handbook of Literature, the standard textbook definition of satire that I would teach a student in any introductory literature class who said, hey, what's satire? I would open and read them this definition, and then I want to work from that definition, because I actually think that unlike most such definitions, it's a very good one. The definition goes like this. Satire is a literary manner that blends criticism with humor for the purpose of improving humanity or human institutions. This definition gives three criteria which must be met in order to consider something satire. One of them is a very, very subjective criteria and requires us to make an assessment of motive. The other two are whether we judge the satire, the work proposed as satire, to have both criticism and humor. Lots of fine lines to draw. Not everybody's going to decide the same things for every work. And that's okay. But it does give us some ideas to think with. And one thing it suggests, at least to me, is that any work of literature proposed to satire that does not meet each of these three criteria should be considered something else. And I'd like to propose three something else's to consider as we think about satire as a literary manner. If a work is critical but not humorous, the proper term for it is invective. Invective can be an extremely useful way to improve humanity and human institutions, and I would not want to say anything to discount its value. The most famous invectives of all time are in the Old Testament, Book of Jeremiah, and we call such invectives today Jeremiads. Often, invective uses the tool of the satirist, imitation, parody, pastiche, defamiliarization, demonization, but these tools are employed without humor, or at least for ultimately unhumorous ends. I have just been dealing with two very recent works, of Mormon literature that I would that are often proposed as satire that I would consider invectives. One of them is Neil LaBute's Bash, and one of them is Brian Evanson's Father of Lies. I think they're wonderful works. I think they're instructive, morally useful works of literature, but they are not ultimately satire because they are humorless. They're invective. If a work treats a subject humorously, even mockingly, without making specific criticisms, I think the work should best be referred to as a lampoon. Lampoons are often confused with satire, but in my mind, they are very distinct things. The lampoonist is primarily interested in making a joke, while the satirist is primarily interested in making a point. Like the inveyor, the lampoonist may use all of the tools of satire to make fun of her target, but with lampoon, making fun will be an end in and of itself. A great deal, I would say most of what passes for satire in our culture is lampoon. The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, Politically Incorrect, Jay Leno, these things often defend themselves as satire. I don't think they are satire. They make a joke. If they're making a point, the point is incidental because the joke is what's important. To my mind, that's not satire. Again, two works of Mormon literature that we originally talked about as including in this panel as examples of Mormon satire, I move into the category of lampoon. Those are Plan 10 from Outer Space and Orgasmo, both of which have been put forth as movies that satirize Mormon culture. I don't buy it. These are works that lampoon Mormon culture. If they criticize, the criticisms are incidental. They're trying to be funny, primarily. That does not, in my mind, qualify as satire. The third category, or the third term that we would reject in the definition to cause some other kind of literature, is something that criticizes humorously, but without the intention, without the purpose of improving, but with the intention of humiliating or offending or degrading. And this is something that I would classify as sarcasm and not satire. And here is where I want to focus a great deal of what I want to say, because it's very difficult to distinguish sarcasm from satire, and to do so requires that we make a moral judgment. Is the person, is the text, is the satire or sarcasm coming from a perspective of love, of respect, a perspective of wanting to improve, or is it coming from a perspective of trying to destroy or to tear down? Different people, again, are going to draw those lines differently, and both will look very much alike. Satirists are almost always perceived as sarcastic by their targets. Writers of sarcasm are almost always defended as satirists by their defenders. I believe it is the most crucial distinction that I can try to make here today. And again, it's not a distinction of the end result, because the end result is going to be the same. Criticizing, making fun of, mocking the satirist and there's just no adjective verb for sarcasm. The sarcastist are going to do the same things. They're going to be motivated differently, and that moral judgment of motivation, while difficult, perilous, probably inexact, to me makes all of the difference in the world. Let me make a few general observations about satire, then I want to talk about Jesus and Cherie. In that order, giving Jesus the possible benefit of the doubt anyway. Cherie's really good, too. But, you know, we're going to talk about Jesus first. Three general observations about how satire compares to these other three genres. First, satire is a much more effective form of criticism than invective. I think they're both useful. I think they're both good. I do not think invective is immoral. I think the writings of Jeremiad and Father of Lies are wonderful. But in general, satire works better because the humor gives people the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. Two greatest examples of satire I could think of, when Cherie asked me when we were in this panel, what's great modern satire, what's like a TV show, two best examples I could think of were All in the Family and MASH. Because All in the Family was something that bigots watched and laughed at because it was funny. MASH is something I still remember my own father, who's very, very against the anti-war movement, watching MASH, talking about how liberal it was, but watching it every single week because it was funny. You tune in for the humor, you get the criticism. And satire does that. It makes when it includes satiric criticism. It makes it much more effective because it makes it much more palatable. It makes people willing to watch it, read it, see it, perceive it, and therefore willing to subject themselves to being influenced, even though they may know they're being influenced against their own position. It's funny enough, you know, just to see Burns, you know, get his pants taken off was funny enough for my father to sit through 17 minutes a week of political indoctrination. That's satire. Secondly, satire, for those interested in criticizing a very powerful community, satire has always provided plausible deniability. And this goes back to Daniel Defoe, who was actually imprisoned for writing a paper called The Shortest Way with Dissenters, in which he, as a dissenting Protestant, advocated the extermination of dissenting Protestants, and he was imprisoned for advocating extermination. He argued that he was writing satire, and the English court, English House of Lords, ruled that satire was not a defense. The result is that satire cannot be a prosecution, and we got Jonathan Swift, who could never be prosecuted because satire, not being a defense, could not be a prosecution. You take what is said literally, what's implied, you can deny. So very, very powerful, very possibly subversive. Okay, the second point I'd like to make, satire is a much more ethical use of humor than lampoon. The lampoonist is primarily interested in being funny. I don't think lampoon is unethical. I think it's morally neutral. It's funny. I like Saturday Night Live. I watch at least one episode of The Simpsons a day when I'm taking care of my son. And, you know, he likes the cartoon and I like the humor. So I think that lampoon is great, but I don't think it's positively moral. I simply think it's funny, it's entertaining, but it doesn't have the same moral resonance to me that satire has. Satire, for me, is an extremely moral action. Compared to sarcasm, which is an extremely immoral action to me, because of what's behind what's being written or produced or propagated, because of the motivation. Even though it looks the same, the satirist, from the human perspective, honestly loves humanity and wants to improve them. The sarcastist, I need a word, the sarcastist hates humanity and wants to destroy it. And to me, that makes all of the difference. And what I want to talk about now is how this model, which is a fairly well-accepted model of how satire works in a human community, would be applied to a specific kind of satire, Mormon satire, Christian satire, Jewish satire. I would argue that the same principles are true. Mormon satire, in my opinion, I keep qualifying this, I know, but it's opinion, can only be written by somebody deeply invested in Mormon culture, with a love of Mormon people and a genuine desire to improve them. This does not mean that the person is an apologist. As a matter of fact, satirists very often get stoned, killed, exiled for what they write. But that motivation has to be there. Otherwise, we have sarcasm, possibly lampoon, but not satire. Every once in a while, I read a review of a work. Working in Mormon literature as an avocation, moving towards a vocation as I do, that talks about how something satirizes Mormonism. Tony Kushner's Angels in America was widely represented as satirizing Mormonism. Orgasmo, the Roger Ebert review, talks about it as satirizing Mormonism. I would argue that this is an impossible formulation. Kushner, and while I think that Angels in America is a very good work of human satire, and a very moral and ethical work, and it's something that I praise quite a bit, I don't have an axe to grind with it, it's not Mormon satire. It is human satire, but it's not Mormon satire because Kushner couldn't care less whether the Mormons improve or not. He's using Mormons to satirize somebody else, but he's not satirizing Mormons. And I believe it's incorrect to use that formulation, because one can only satirize Mormons who, and I'm not, is a Mormon, or is an active Mormon, or is a faithful Mormon, I won't put that condition on it, but who is invested enough in the culture to care greatly what happens to it. And that is the position from which true satire must be written. Let me move now to the title of the panel, Jesus Was a Funny Guy. And let me tell you, I have to 11:45, right, Cherie?
Yep.
Okay, I'll tell you where this comes from. I recently, in the devotional this morning, I talked about an experience I had teaching this world literature class, which is one of the main things I teach. It was very enlightening for me. I had another experience that was actually very depressing for me. I taught the New Testament in this class, and I taught the Sermon on the Mount, and I made the point that Jesus was extremely ironic and being very funny, and that there was a strong humorous criticism in the Sermon on the Mount. And I had a student get up and walk out. And I had several other students email me and tell me that I was being blasphemous, that how could I say these things about Jesus, that they simply... Oh, to the mic, I'm sorry. They simply... I thought we didn't have a mic. Oh, it's taping. That they simply were not prepared to accept that Jesus could have been a funny guy. And this wasn't at BYU, mind you. This was at a state college where I didn't have to apologize to anybody for saying it. And my job wasn't on the line after I got through, which felt really good. I could tell the students, I don't care what you think about Jesus, and that was fine. But I went back, and the more I read the Sermon on the Mount and the other writings of Jesus, the more impressed I am that Jesus is working out of a rabbinical tradition that is deeply ironic, very funny. And I have gotten to the point where there are lines that I chuckle openly in at the New Testament. Lines like when Jesus tells his followers not to strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. I think that's funny. When he tells them in the Sermon on the Mount that they should not give their arms alms by blowing a horn in front of them. That's a funny image to me. I think he's using a very, very standard kind of rabbinical verbal irony to get a point across. I've sat through some Sunday school lessons right now trying to explain exactly how camels go through the eyes of a needle. That I just now raise my hand every time and I say, it's a joke. Can't you get this? Jesus is telling a joke. There's no back door to Jerusalem. There's no... That's called the eye. It's funny, people. When he tells the people in the Sermon on the Mount that they shouldn't disfigure their faces when they fast. That's a funny image. See, it's funny. It's humor. When he tells people that God can make children of Abraham out of rock, so they shouldn't feel so darn special. See, it's funny. Jesus was a funny guy. And with this observation, I began to formulate my notion that the Sermon on the Mount can be very productively read as a work of satire because it contains this verbal irony. And satire doesn't have to be situational. That's a mistake. Since Rabelais and Swift and Cervantes, most satire has been situational. Before that, with Horace and Juvenal and, Lucian was situational, but Horace and Juvenal were not situational satirists. The early great Roman satirists, they just said what they said in a verbally ironic way, and that was the satire. From that perspective, I think the Sermon on the Mount is an excellent example of what I would call Horatian satire. Humorous, but its main point is not to be funny. Its main point is to make a strong criticism about the way that the Jews had conceived of their relationship to God through the law of Moses. He makes that criticism, and he makes it humorously, and he makes it from a point of investment within the culture. And he makes it because of a genuine desire that the culture improve. He doesn't sugarcoat it. He tells people what he thinks. He offends some of the most powerful religious leaders in his community, and he gets killed for it. You could never call Jesus a Jewish apologist. I think you could call him a great Jewish satirist. And I think you can call his model an excellent model for Christian satire and for Mormon satire. Just to close up, until recently, I would have argued that I did not see any true satire in the Mormon community. 3 years ago, I changed my mind. And I just want to tell this experience now to introduce our next speaker. I got a forwarded news story in my email account about a kindergarten in Brigham City, Utah, that was in turmoil because a teacher had allowed same-sex couples to play Farmer in the Dell. And when the farmer took a wife... Did anybody else get this email? I read this, and my wife brought it to me and said, is this for real? And I said, it might be. This could be true. And then the thing that tipped it off is I read all the names in there. Lashana and Lavana and LaDonna. And I said, no, this is a brilliant satirist at work, and I wish I knew who it were. It was signed C.K. Woodworth, and who was C.K. Woodworth anyway? I then read with interest as this article went on to be reported as straight news throughout the country. And radio stations and newspapers were reporting this at news, and I thought, C.K. Woodworth is really good. Again, I did not know C.K. Woodworth yet. Over the last 3 years, I've read dozens of C.K. Woodworth's very, very good satires. I've come to know C.K., Cherie, I call her, to understand that she has a strong devotion to the Mormon community, also a brilliant eye for understanding its follies, its vices, its hypocrisies, a willingness to use humor to point those things out without losing sight of a genuine desire for their improvement. So I'd just like to present her to you as the next speaker, as somebody who I believe is really one of our great working satirists in the Mormon community, perhaps our only working satirist from the definition that I proposed. Without further ado, here's Cherie.
That was a very flattering introduction. I did not arrange this panel just so that Mike would say those nice things about me. I started thinking about this only very recently when I was trying to figure out what I had already been doing for several years, and why I always felt like I was on the verge of getting in trouble, but never actually got in trouble, at least not yet, not formally, not that I know of. I'm speaking today from a bit of distance. I'm speaking as a critic and as an observer. This is partly because of the way I feel as the author now, a point I'll get back to at the end of my presentation, and partly as I felt when when the Farmer and the Mill story first arose, and as I felt with subsequent stories that I've written. It happens because I feel, in a sense, like I have a mask or a persona that I put on, or more like that possesses me. It would be irreverent to say that this is my most inspired writing, but if anything comes wholesale into my head, it's from a column of light descending from heaven or some other force. It's these news stories. They come into my head, I sit down, I write them out straight away the first time. If I have to stop and think about it, they always get muddled up and too slow and bogged down. But somehow there's a kernel that just starts, and it won't stop until I've written it out and sent it off. And when I'm writing it, I feel like I'm a different person. I feel like I'm in the persona of usually the harried journalist who's on the scene trying to get this story out, making a few mistakes, can't stop and check every fact. You get a few things wrong, put a few things in that you don't need. And also that I'm a male persona. Actually, I was very pleased to find that most people took those initials and assumed that I was a man. It gives me a kind of defense that I can hide behind this man who is C.K. Woodworth, who writes these horrible, nasty, critical things. To give you an example, I did bring a copy of The Farmer in the Dell. I'd like to pass that out. Mike has them down there right now. Yep, that's it. Because
okay.
I thought most of you would be familiar with this, and we could use it as an example to look at what's going on now that I go back and look at them. It's not self-conscious when I write it. Again, it just sort of comes out. As sort of preparatory material, I can tell you that I did work professionally as a journalist for less than a year. It was in the Soviet Union, which exposes you to cliches of journalism in a very extreme form, and also limits of censorship in what you can say, what you can't say, and the power of journalism and of speaking in a hidden way about things. I was a card-carrying news reporter for TASS, the Soviet news agency, for about a year. I didn't write a lot of stories, but I got at least indoctrinated into formal journalistic writing, where you have a lead and you have a certain pace, the way things go. So if you look at this example, this actually sets out many of the characteristics which I instinctively followed in my later classes. It has a sensational headline, furor erupts. It really is meant to grab your attention. It's meant to get you all excited about something. The first paragraph has these bright flashing words, emergency session, there's allegations, there's children being inculcated, there's some sort of ideology going on. This must be something really awful. The second paragraph gets down to the details and gives you the detail that it's this little game that they're playing on the playground. And this begins to set up the absurdity of it, of how we're reading so much into this tiny little thing that's happening. And then it gradually unfolds as you begin to say, oh, so what's more about this story? And you read on. You get the parents' response, a little bit of exposition. The purpose of this is to imitate the rhetoric, pacing, and rhythm of a real news story, of course. And also to make up quotes from people which sound plausible. For example, the parent, Lisa Perkins, who says, it's upsetting the natural order of things, and it's upsetting me, too. I had an image of her in my mind somehow when I wrote that. She was in tears. She was so upset about what was happening. And the point of it is to actually lead you through a series of absurdities which culminate by the end, so that by the end, but not too far before the end, you're saying to yourself, this can't really have happened. And hopefully by that point you've gone through stages and you can then look back on it and see it as all made up. Part of casting them in news writing style came about because naturally of being on email and getting news reports by email. If you're in, say, the Mormon intellectual community or what we might call the dissident community I'm trying to think of a more positive way, people who are invested and concerned about things that are happening and don't trust everything in the church news, you get a lot of information by email, as I do. And turning this back around is also a way of satirizing the way we ourselves send information around and send rumors around, and also a way of imitating what we take as an authority voice when we're reading on email. And email is a perfect genre for this because it's not actually a newspaper. It has the appearance of having appeared in a newspaper, but it's stripped of all its context. You just get this post in your inbox. It's a genre that works extremely well also for another reason, and that is that I like to put it on to the individual decision of any recipient whether to send it on or not, whether they pick the audience and think that the person will understand what's going on, so that I cannot, since I can't answer for the responsibility for every person who's going to read this, that they're going to get it, I usually send it off to a relatively small group of people who I know will understand what's going on. And if they send it further, it's on their heads. It's not my fault. And if, you know, somebody reads it and it gets all in a dudgeon, it's like, talk to the person who sent it to you, because I wouldn't have sent it to you. I don't know you. I can't really explain it. It almost seems supernatural, the way things have worked out. But this particular news story also introduced themes that have come up again and again over the last 3 years as I've been writing these. Part of them, partly because they're themes which are of great concern to me, and also because they're themes which keep coming up in the church community. Mormons and their self-image, constantly a preoccupation. Mormons and popular culture, how we relate to that. And Mormons and their public image. All of these, for example, come up constantly in the church news. That's what the church news is about, Mormons and public image, and Mormons and their self-image. Also, family values and gay issues keep coming up because this is a really hot point and point of tension in the church right now, as you probably know, and women's and men's roles, which is something that it always feels like a point of tension to me because I feel very constrained by the rhetoric that comes out officially. Brigham Young University is also a theme that I have, it's also a target which I have lavished much loving attention on. And it's true because I do feel very invested in BYU, and I feel really disappointed and hurt about things that have happened there. And that's a good way of looking at what's behind these stories as I write them. It's usually something that I feel very, very attached to, and I'm hurt by the way things are turning out. And that's true also of what I would say is my final theme, which keeps coming back, which is the church leadership and how we relate to the church leadership and how they relate to us. Essentially, all of these themes are getting back to the same point, which is saying, who are we? Who has the authority to define who we are? And who has the authority to speak about it? The way that the Mormon community is set up now, the authority structures are very well defined, but the non-authorized voices have also found avenues for speaking and whole fields of expression that they didn't previously have, a lot through the internet and electronic means. When I talk about who has the authority to speak, I was reminded also by what Kirby was saying last night. Kirby was talking about his experience as a policeman, and he was the authority figure. And I could sense that he was talking when he's making jokes as a policeman, the jokes don't come off to his victims because they can only see him as an authority figure. And yet, in a way, he's joking back on himself, saying, okay, I'm wearing the uniform, but I don't really feel like an authority figure. I'm an authority and I'm not an authority. And by writing these news stories, I am very often setting myself up with a false authority voice as the news correspondent, or I am pulling down those authorities which are officially set up in the church. Pulling down not in a bad way, but sort of deflating or showing their human side, or just cautioning members not to put them on a pedestal and take them as not take them as idols or take them as flawless authorities. And with that, we can move on to the second example, which is also sitting right there in front of Mike. This is an example of another authority genre. It's the official memorandum, which again, it just came on me, something that needed to be written. This arose out of stories several years ago about Gordon B. Hinckley being greeted with handkerchief waving. We've recently gone through another series of handkerchief ceremonies. This is unrelated to that. I haven't yet found a need to comment on the most recent handkerchief fetish. I don't know if I will. Let's see. I think you'll have to give me a copy of that, too.
I think we have just enough, Sheree, but...
So instead of imitating or mocking, mimicking a news story, in this one I'm mimicking the sort of memos or official letters which I imagine get sent to bishops all over the country. I've never been a bishop, so I don't know. But somehow when someone gets up and reads something and says, I have an official letter from church headquarters which I have to read in sacrament meeting, I imagine it to be something like this. Central directive from the Central Office for Protocol and Hierarchical Observation somewhere in the church office building, in that vast bureaucracy, we don't really know what goes on there, about gradations of respect for visiting church leaders. And you probably know that the hierarchy among the Quorum of the Twelve and the church leaders is something that they themselves have explicitly said. And it's not something I made up. It's something, again, that is just... I mean, they're asking for it when they do something like that. So they have supposedly this set of hierarchy by seniority. So I figured there ought to be handkerchiefs to go with every one of these positions. White handkerchiefs for the president of the church, yellow handkerchiefs for Thomas Monson, yellow, nice cheery color. Don't read too much into this. This is literally what comes out of my head the very first shot. Pink handkerchiefs for James B. Phelps. Heaven only knows why. Lilac for Boyd K. Packer. Well, that was kind of a dig because, you know, lilac is the color of the gay rights movement. Quorum of 12 powder blue handkerchiefs, royal blue, red bandanas, one for Merrill Bateman since I think he's bucking to be a general authority of the highest order. He gets pom-poms, his nice proper BYU spirit. And then, of course, course, if you're going to have official approved uses of handkerchiefs, you've got to have them distributed by the church channels through the church distribution center, and you've got to have them come in economy packages, because Mormons are always concerned about, you know, saving a penny here or there. I couldn't think of all of the possible priesthood ranks that might be honored with handkerchiefs, so I just sort of lumped them all in at the bottom, down to ward executive clerks. If you are an executive clerk, we'll figure something out for you. What is actually one of my favorite things about this memorandum is it not only has the authority of being a memo, but it has footnotes and references, in case you wanted to go look them up. Elder Boyd K. Packers, notice we use the title and the middle initial, the whole thing. The BYU address really did happen, and it was partly in response to that that I wrote this. Follow your file leader. I don't recall right now whether that happened or not, but it very well could have. And the others are entirely made up, right down to the four-volume comprehensive correlation compendium, which is partly going off information I have from the church office building that they do make these giant volumes of for internal circulation only. In this case, it was for the translation department that I saw them. But, you know, who knows? Maybe they have them for correlation as well. In fact, I'm sure they do. It's one of these things where you feel prophetic. You say, if it doesn't exist, I bet it does somewhere. I actually thought this was quite dangerous when I wrote this. And I still think it's dangerous because it is very disrespectful to the leaders. And to church members who really honor and venerate leaders, I think that they would probably see this as disrespectful to the point of sarcasm. But I think Mike Austin was very, very right when he said it's a fine line to draw, and you have to, in a sense, look at what's in my heart when I write it, which you can't know. But I know that I wouldn't have written this if I didn't care what the church leaders were doing and how they were putting themselves off and how the members were interpreting this. As I said, I thought it was a dangerous thing to write. Humor is a dangerous thing. I have felt with virtually everyone that I've written that it was a dangerous thing to write and a dangerous thing to send off. It reminds me of the novel The Name of the Rose, which I went back and reread recently, where if you recall, there's murders taking place in the monastery, within the religious community, and it's all about a debate about humor and how to use humor. And it's not only dangerous, but to keep the monks from thinking about humor and to keep the monks from laughing about them, the villain of the story, this old, old monk, who's very, very serious, threatens them with the apocalypse and with heresy. And these are two very real threats that scare people. And he tells them they should not talk about humor, and they certainly should not laugh at things, because heresy is always nigh, and the apocalypse is coming. On the other hand, what could be the most powerful tool against both of these, against heresy, or against anybody who has a disagreement? If the problem with heretics is they take themselves so seriously. If you laugh at them, you know, poke fun at them, you have deflated them as well. And also with the Antichrist, who appears as a very real character in The Name of the Rose, what could be more powerful than to laugh at the Antichrist? He would have no power over you, I believe, at least. Nevertheless, feeling that this is a dangerous thing to do and a dangerous thing to write, what purpose justifies this? And I also feel responsible for people who get offended. What purpose justifies that potential offense for people? First of all, I want to warn people to read carefully, things they get by email, but also to read carefully things that they get in the Ensign or the church news, always to read carefully and to read thoughtfully about what you're being presented with. Secondly, there is a strong element of criticism here. If people don't know that the story is invented, it has no purpose. If they don't know why it's invented, then it also has no purpose. Then it is just invective, if they don't understand that there's a justifiable criticism there. Whether it's right or not to take aim at the church leaders, I can only say again that in a position of power and authority, and I am not, I, in a sense, play the fool to them. But I was thinking about this, I'm thinking about it in the Shakespearean sense, partly because of an essay which occurred recently. What is the fool? The fool is not someone who just jokes and makes people laugh, but the fool in Shakespeare is somebody who cares very much for the person they're attached to. This essay cited several plays like Rosalind in Out in the Woods, and her fool is getting her to think more seriously about what it means to fall in love. And the most famous fool is, of course, the fool in King Lear. And the most famous absent fool, as pointed out in this essay, is Yorick in Hamlet. And Hamlet is in tragedy, partly because Yorick is not there to lighten him up and to give him some ironic distance to be able to look at his situation. This essayist concluded talking about the fool, about the fool's attachment to the object of the foolishness. In Shakespeare, to have a fool attending you is generally a mark of distinction. And that is certainly true for church leaders. I pick them out because they have this high position. It also means that you've retained some flexibility and can learn things and might change. It means that you're not quite past hope. And that is also true. I have not given up, even if I feel that church leaders may have done things which I think are wrong. I certainly haven't given up on church leadership. And also, the fool is for the audience, because the fool, by putting out satire, tests our capacity to hear the truth in slant, peculiar, and painful forms, and using this to take steps towards general freedom. I wouldn't set myself up in such high company, but to see that explained that way, that's something that I would like to strive for. If there is a purpose, if there is a justification for doing these things, it would be that sort of justification. On the other hand, Mike Austin said to me at some other time, good satire will make people want to write letters to the editor. And I said, I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to provoke people's anger. I don't want letters. And I don't think that anger in that sense is good, because if people get angry and defensive, they're not thinking about what's going on. So I think Mike's right, but it doesn't make me want to write satire. Praise also makes me uncomfortable. And this is an odd thing which I've worked with over the past few years. I don't really like people to praise me for these things that I've done, because, again, I see it as being done behind a mask. There's some other persona who's doing it. I didn't quite understand why I was uncomfortable with this praise until I read a very insightful essay in The New Yorker about Daumier, who's currently on an exhibit here in Washington, who's a French satirist. And what the essayist had to say about Daumier's character, I felt, described my experience of trying to deal with this as being the author and yet not the author of these pieces. That essayist wrote that satirists are shy and elusive people. I do feel pretty shy. I don't want to put myself out this way. And they want us to look at what they're looking at, not at them. And that's something I definitely feel. I would much, much prefer to hear somebody say, oh, that piece, I don't know who wrote it, but it sure made me think about X. Or I sent it to my mother-in-law, and boy, we sure got in discussion over this issue. Something like this. To return to the first example, as I said, I found themes that I set up in this very first Farmer and the Dell story keep coming back. And it's almost uncanny, but one of those themes, one of the reasons that satire makes sense, is said by this mother in the story, the one who was in tears, Lisa Perkins. She said, it's upsetting the natural order of things, and it's upsetting me. And she was talking about what's happening in the kindergarten. But that's what satire does. It upsets the thing that you think to be normal order. And it upsets you, I hope. I hope it also is entertaining. But by upsetting it, it allows you to reorganize them and think through things. The purpose of satire is to mimic reality in a way that can turn it on its head. And so it's a setup for reversal. What makes it worthwhile is the impulse behind it, I think, which I finally saw just this morning, looking back at the story which I wrote 3 years ago, almost to the day, is what's said by the poor kindergarten teacher when she tries to defend what she did. She says, I just wanted all the children to have a turn. And I now turn over to Bruce Hayes, who is our respondent, who is a specialist in Rabelais and French literature from Yale University, and he's going to talk about Christ in Rabelaisian literature. First.
I'm a virgin sunstoner. This feels pretty good. I got turned down for a BYU job, and so I'd just like to make sure that there's no more chances of that happening to me again. I want to tell a true story. Speaking of Sharice, handkerchief waving in our church's obsession with hierarchy, up in New Haven, anyone they can grab off the street, they'll make a high counselor. And so I was a high counselor, and I would go to the meetings and naturally sit where I should sit, which was as far away from the stake president as possible. And I did this for about a year, just, you know, wherever the furthest seat available was, I would sit there. And after a year, as, quote, marked by gross, robust humor, extravagance of caricature, or bold naturalism. Now, bold naturalism is a euphemism for pee-pee caca, okay? As my three-year-old would explain, bold naturalism. Rabelais became known to a larger academic audience thanks to the work by Mikhail Bakhtin, which was translated into English as Rabelais and His World. Bakhtin's reading of Rabelais' work was highly original and fascinating, though ultimately incorrect, but that's not important here. An important point that Bakhtin makes point that he made about humor, specifically medieval humor, is that it is inherently ambivalent. He argued that in the modern world we have separated and polarized humor so that it must be either positive or negative, while in Rabelais' time humor's function was both. I would argue that all good satire is fundamentally ambivalent. Without this ambivalence, it becomes either invective or lighthearted humor. The good satirist, and I'm echoing Mike, we didn't plan this, but these are my feelings as well, that the good satirist is engaged in his or her subject, for it is essential that she do more than simply make fun of things that don't particularly interest her if the satire is to be successful. Rabelais was indeed a committed satirist. His environment was Reform-era 16th century France, after Luther and Calvin had already broken away from the Catholic Church. This was a turbulent period of Reformation and Counter-Reformation, the humanist movement, a period we benignly refer to as the Renaissance. Rabelais was, among other things, a Franciscan monk. He was very reform-minded, shared many of Erasmus's sentiments about the church, but, like Erasmus, chose to remain Catholic, and even took swipes at Luther and Calvin in his writings. Like so many other humanists, Rabelais was trying to return to original sources, leaving the Vulgate Bible for the original Hebrew and Greek, studying Greek poets and philosophers in the original, rather than in adulterated Latin translations, which, having studied the Middle Ages, some of those get a little goofy, and I think you'd find a lot of parallels in modern Mormon. I'm making a joke without you having a subtext. The medievals were obsessed with wanting to read this really good stuff from the classics, but knowing that it wasn't palatable, and so my favorite is called Ovid Moralisé, which is Ovid. If anyone's read Ovid, it's scandalous, so let's moralize Ovid, and let's take all of the lewd details and funny bits and force a biblical exegesis upon them. And anyway, this is not without fellow in our current community. So, along with this, Rabelais was extremely interested in the origins of Christianity. He was what was called an evangelical humanist, two words that had vastly different meanings than their modern equivalents. Rabbi preached a return to the fundamental principles of the gospel and severely mocked and attacked artifices in the church that had been built up over time and worked to separate people from Christ and his message. The message Rabbi was most interested in was charity. Rabelais wrote books recounting the adventures of the giants Gargantua and Pantagruel. If you use the word Gargantua, you have Rabelais to thank for that. His first book was simply called Pantagruel. Scholars have long considered the giant Pantagruel to represent Rabelais' ideal humanist prince, as the giant repeatedly demonstrates his erudition and wisdom throughout the works. But recently, Edwin Duval, my thesis advisor, published a book on the Pantagruel that argues convincingly that Pantagruel represents not only a secular ideal, but a religious one as well. By using not only classical sources as subtext but to the work, but biblical ones as well, Duval demonstrates that Pantagruel is a figura Christi, or a Christ figure. Now, if you've read the Pantagruel, you probably find such an assertion preposterous and absurd, if not blasphemous. This is a book full of scatological humor, irreverence, and it is highly satirical. This is underlined by the fact that Pantagruel's best friend and companion is a little scoundrel named Panurge, a most unlovable character. Some of the milder things that Panurge does is steals people's purses and then uses the money as dowries to marry off old prostitutes. And in a central episode of the work, he vulgarly humiliates a woman referred to as the haughty lady of Paris after she rebuffs his amorous advances. So what are we to make of his antics? There are important biblical subtexts that Panurge fulfills through his shenanigans. One is, and the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. And another is, whosoever shall exalt himself or herself shall be abased. Panurge acts as a trickster who, despite his vulgarity, makes Christ's words a reality through the humiliating reversals he produces. Now, what are we to make of Pantagruel's approval of his lewd companion? Well, let's talk about who Christ hung out with. Pantagruel is the perfect embodiment of charity, as he is able to love unconditionally the most unlovable Panurge. Ned Duval sums up the spirit of the Pantagruel by saying that, quote, "The Pantagruel is silly and scandalous in the same way and for the same reasons that Christianity, the Bible, and Christ himself are silly and scandalous." Rabelais, through his silly and scandalous tale, is echoing the words of Paul. "If any man among you seemeth to be wise in the world, let him become a fool, that he may be wise." And later, "We are fools for Christ's sake." Now, moving on briefly to Mormon satire today, this is what I have to say. Satire serves to make us aware in a humorous way of problems and contradictions with our beliefs and actions. It helps us in our quest to determine what is essential, what is non-essential, and especially what is potentially dangerous to our spiritual progression. Satire is a dangerous genre, as Sri has said. Rabelais was persecuted by the Sorbonne, the French Catholic equivalent of the BYU administration. He was placed on the index, Catholic equivalent of the Strengthening the Members Committee, and quite frankly, without some powerful protectors, Rabelais would have most likely been burned at the stake. Today we need to listen to the satirist's voice, even if we don't necessarily agree with what she is saying. Rather than demonstrating the same conservative repressive reactions typical of previous generations, as we look back at great satirists such as Swift, Voltaire, and Rabelais, we are attracted to them not just because they were clever or funny, but because they exposed very real problems that seem obvious to us now, yet the problems they highlighted were not at all obvious to many of their contemporaries. Let me end quickly with a warning to myself and to those who consider themselves to one degree or another Mormon intellectuals. Satire makes people uncomfortable because it presents as silly what certain people take very things that certain people take very seriously. I appreciated reading one of Cherie's satires where she poked fun at Sunstone's president. When we criticize others for taking things seriously that are really quite silly, we need to make sure that we don't fall into the same trap by taking ourselves too seriously. Let me finish with a final episode from the Pantagruel. This is the first time that Pantagruel and his buddies meet Panurge, who will become his epic companion. They see Panurge. He is completely emaciated, disheveled, clothes torn, starving to death. And Pantagruel says, "Guess what, guys? This man, although he looks like he should live in a gutter, I have a good feeling about him. I know he's somebody good." So they approach him and they say to him, "Good man, tell us your name and your story that has brought you to this, because we know you are someone good." And Panurge replies in a foreign language. He then proceeds to respond to each of their consecutive queries in 9 different foreign languages, 2 of them invented, 7 real, including and most importantly, the holy trinity of languages for humanists, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. What he is saying in the 9 different versions in some form or another is, "Hey, I'm hungry. Give me something to eat, let me sleep, and I'll tell you my story." Of course, they don't understand any of this. Finally, Pantagruel says to him, "But man, do you speak French?" And he responds, "Why, yes, it's my maternal tongue." Panurge in this episode is being pedagogical, and what he is trying to teach them is, this is Rabelais kind of poking fun at his fellow humanists, because the purpose of the languages is to point out the fact that you missed the most obvious language of all, and that is body language. Take a look at me. Help me. And I end with a scripture that is the subtext of that story. "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass or tinkling cymbal." Thank you.
I think we are actually just about officially out of time. But I think since the next thing up is lunch. The next thing up is lunch, and we have a 10-minute break.
This is not funny.
All right, this thing lunch is not funny. But if you have any questions, we will entertain the first 3 questions, and then we will all go to lunch if there are any questions. Albert, what's your question?
Are you an equal opportunity lampooner? Are you lampooning the liberals?
I, very early on, did a satire of Sunstone attendees in which they were dressed up as beehive-headed aliens. They were going down to the coffee shop to get their coffee. They were getting on their email because they couldn't wait to spread the latest gossip. They were, and they were standing around in the halls doing it. Yeah, I think Sunstone attendees are ripe for satire. We're a weird bunch. I think that would be... just the one that comes to mind right now. Dave Barber.
This is a question for Mike.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of satirists in the modern community, what about the brilliant cartoonists that they published in Sunstone, like Pat Bagley and Cal Brundle? And do you see that? I mean, do they fit your classification?
Sometimes, yes. I would more often call them lampoons, funny and enjoyable, things that I like. Some of them really are very satirical. Yeah, and I like them.
And the last question from over here.
How can I tell that you're not mocking just from reading? Because in the definitions,
yeah,
I got was intent that's unarticulated. It's something from the heart, mm-hmm, but it doesn't come out of the product. So if I'm a mocker and I read you as a satirist,
yeah,
we're from 2 different directions. How can I clarify that? If I'm the church and I'm sensitive to invective and sarcasm.
Pray about it. all I can tell you is the way I feel right now. And it was described in this review of Daumier, there is very often a hurt behind what I write, and I'm hurt because I feel so attached
to the Mormon community.
How do I know that?
And you don't know me, so you don't know that.
So you're really, there's no distinction.
Mike, if...
Tell the policy or in, definition or procedure.
Mike, in if you have only the text sent to you electronically.
It's impossible to ever make those kinds of moral decisions, absolutely, and I think it's always important to try. But you can never say with certainty what somebody's
so
thinking.
So the church reading you would always think of you as sarcastic and mocking, wouldn't they?
Satirists get that rap.
Yeah. Okay.
They always have. They kill Jesus.
Mm. I will confess one thing. I don't send them to my parents.
Is that sensitivity or fear?
They can't read that from me. I've sent them the most mild thing. I think the one where it was the spring that the Seinfeld show was going off the air and everybody was talking about why was this happening. And almost all of the ones that you have, I wrote while I was in Estonia. So I figured if news reached me in Estonia, it must be really big in the United States. And I wrote back, the reason Jerry Seinfeld was quitting the show is because he was becoming Mormon. And it just didn't fit his lifestyle anymore. He was going to pitch a new show to the station, to the networks, in which he played a nice married fellow, and his wife would be Marie Osmond, and they would have children, and it would be really funny. Except, of course, it wouldn't be. And Jerry Seinfeld could never be a Mormon, and all the characters on the show, because they're, you know, self-centered and very materialistic, and. I meant that seriously. Jerry Seinfeld is not a character. And they're all Jewish or something like that. I sent that one to my father, and I say I learned my sense of humor from my father. I would credit him with that. And he wrote back to me and said, I'm very concerned about this. You're going to get in trouble. So again, I'm very cautious with audience, and that's one reason that I'm very careful where I send them. And I do put a responsibility on anybody who sends them on, and it's also why Elbert does not publish them. He's talked to me several times and said, we just can't publish this, it's too sharp.
And just to say, as a general rule, a satirist is always going to be misunderstood. And they always have been. It's just the role of the satirist to be miserable and misunderstood, and for nobody to appreciate them. Having been after they die, in which case they become great.
This is your moment.
We're going to dismiss for lunch. I have copies of three more of the news stories, which I didn't have time to discuss, but I'll put them up here and you can follow in. Thank you.